My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Our Father, we ask that you help us to accept and appreciate your blessings, that you help us open our hearts and minds so that we may continue to take those actions of love and service which enable us to live with dignity. And we know if we do these things, you will never leave us to face our problems all alone. Amen.
Hi, I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. It's really great to be here this evening. Billy and I have really been treated well. I'm impressed with the conference that you have here. I don't like to say this, but we don't have one this big in Texas. I don't know whether y'all got more drunks or do it better. I've got to study this a little bit, but this is really, really quite a show. I want to thank our Mike and Liz who picked us up at the airport and gave us their time, and so many of our friends are here. We've enjoyed seeing and talking with them. It's just like coming home. I didn't really realize I knew as many people from Southern California as I do. But you're a warm and friendly group of people. I hope you stay that way. Can you all hear me all right? Can you do it now? Better? I'm not only an alcoholic, but I'm several other things. I'm a lawyer. That'll excite all of you. It's the only profession, I guess, that you're permitted to free resentment. If you're divorced, you're absolutely free to continue to resent your spouse's lawyer through the rest of your life, as near as I can tell. I'm also the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. This is really sort of serendipity, but in 12 days, this lady and I will have been married 33 years. I'd like for you to meet her, my wife, Billy. We were married right here in Long Beach when I was in the Navy here. My wife was teaching school out here, and it seems like a long time ago. I haven't been back since then. But I really got something started that I have not been able to handle for a long time, I'll tell you. I think I'll take her the rest of the way, though, you know. Today you're seeing people with a lot of sobriety in their Al-Anons reaching advanced years. And not too long ago, I heard of a story about a fellow who was down here at the border in Southern California going over to New Mexico. And the border agent, customs agent, was a young woman. And this couple was an Al-Anon and AA, and they'd been married many years. And, of course, the Al-Anon was driving the car, and the old man couldn't hear. He sat there and just kind of looked ahead. And the old lady pulled up and stopped, and the customs agent said, Where are you from? And the old man said, "What'd you say, huh? What'd you say?" She said, "She wants to know where we're from." "We're from Torrance." And the lady said, "My goodness." She said, "Every time I hear that, it reminds me, I had the worst sexual experience of my life in Torrance." And the old man said, "Huh? What'd you say, huh?" And the old lady said, "Be quiet. She thinks she knows you." We have a lot of fun in this fellowship. I find your slogan this time, "Let the miracle happen," to be kind of interesting. It's become so accepted that you can recover from the disease of alcoholism, that the assumption is that the miracle is waiting for you to let it happen. And that's pretty true. This room and the number of people we have here pretty clearly demonstrates that. But it wasn't very long ago, 1935, when those who recovered were truly recognized as experiencing a miracle. It's interesting also to notice that our book of experience, Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, tells us about Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist. Carl Jung, several years before Bill and Dr. Bob met, was treating Roland, a wealthy American industrialist, for alcoholism. And he knew what he was trying to produce. When he failed, after spending a year with Roland, he told Roland, "I can't do anything for an alcoholic like you." And Roland says, "Is there no hope for me?" And he said, "Yes, there is. Occasionally, from time to time, an alcoholic like you recovers. It's a phenomenon. The ideas and the emotions and the values that have been the cornerstone of that person's life are suddenly shifted, and a new set of ideas and concepts and values take place." He said, "As a matter of fact, that's exactly what I've been trying to do with you in this year that I failed." And he sent him away with only the admonition that he try to be involved some way with some kind of a spiritual program where this might take place. It's just, we must not forget that that same phenomena must take place in the lives of each of us, no matter how many of us there are. It's the only way they've ever found to help any appreciable number of alcoholics. And Bill and Bob and the old-timers in this program recorded that process in their book of experience. The thing they can't record, of course, they talk about. But you've got to experience, and that's the one-to-one communication between alcoholics. The greatest principle in our program, the principle of experience. What man has done, man can do. I was raised out in West Texas, and I had a loving mom and dad, and we were poor folks, and didn't know we were poor. We just didn't have electricity and things like that. And I used to go to town once a week on Saturday, and I'd watch the town kids ride bicycles. I didn't know anybody out in the country that had a bicycle. But I wanted one, and my dad, I nagged him long enough, he finally got down the Sears and Roebuck catalog and ordered me a bicycle. And he brought it home, or the mailman brought it, and we got the directions out and put it together. And he was through with his work at that point and gave the bicycle to me. It never occurred to me that there would be any problem at all in riding a bicycle. Everyone I saw ride bicycles, it just seemed like it was real easy to do. And so I got out there and I swung up on this thing and went right over the top and busted my can. And I got up and I got on a little more cautiously the next time, and it happened again. And in a little bit I went in the house and told my mother I needed some help. I said, "I can't ride that bicycle." So she got out there, and the drill was she'd trot along beside me and hold me up, and then she would turn me loose and I would fall over. And in West Texas we have stickers called goat heads. And I was getting a fair accumulation of goat heads in my body about this time and some skin places, and we did this a couple of days. And a great truth finally came to me. I had been sold a defective bicycle. I had been sold a bicycle which could not be ridden. And I told my folks this. I got a We got to send the bike back. It won't work. And my mother looked at me. She was a little Irishwoman. She said, Jerry Jones, she said, I have never ridden a bicycle but once or twice in my life, and it was many, many years ago. But I can ride that bicycle. And with a great deal of confidence, I said, you cannot. With that, she got up, she went outside, and she got on the bicycle, and just like I knew it was going to happen, she fell over and busted her can. And I kind of felt sorry for her trying to do that when I knew so well she couldn't do it, and she tried it again. And you know, surprise, surprise. Wasn't pretty. It's kind of wobbly. But she rode that bicycle for 30 yards. She stopped and got off, laid it on the ground and said, if it's going to be ridden, it's up to you. And went in the house. No more trotting along the side. It was my bike and my deal now. And you know, in an hour I was riding that bicycle. And think of the miracle that's happened to us. The fact that we have been given the words and the experience that allow us to see it really does work. It worked for you. It'll work for me. How did you do it? And you've got somebody's life to look at. I had a lot of learning new things to do when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no real idea what alcoholism was. And one of the first things I was told, and one of the first things our books seem to think we need to know, is that alcoholism is a disease. It's a disease that consists of a physical allergy, an inability to ingest ethyl alcohol successfully, and an obsession, an idea, a thought pattern, which tells us always that a drink would make it better. No matter what it is, a drink would make it better. And I had those things, and in a meeting one night I was listening to a guy talk, and I remembered an illustration that I think describes the disease very well. When I was a kid, I had this old dog named Patches who lived out there on the farm with us. Patches was a bulldog, English bulldog mostly. And he was a hell of a dog. He was brave, and he was good with kids, and he was he had a real character. About a week or so before this event I'm going to tell you about, he went up in the field and got in a fight with a badger, which is a pretty tough animal for a dog to fight. Badger weighed a pound more than he did, and took him all morning almost to kill that badger, but he got him killed. And every day for a week he'd go up there in the field and pick that old dead badger up and just shake hell out of him, just to let him know that he was still supposed to be dead and he was boss. On the morning I'm going to tell you about, we had the dog was laying in the front yard of our house and had no problems. No problems. Everybody loved him. He was well fed. He'd been a big hero a couple of weeks ago, won a big badger fight. Everybody was impressed with him. Everything was good. But into our yard walked a big, ugly, 600-pound boar hog. Long yellow tusk. Mean customer. And Patches, like bulldogs would, made a decision to go get hold of the hog. Now, when Patches got hold of the hog, it produced a problem in our barnyard. He was barking and growling, and the hog was squealing, and my dad got out there right away from the shop, and he was kicking hogs and dogs and cussing, and I was worried about my dog, and I got out there and got in the middle of that thing because I knew my dog was going to get killed. My mother saw her kid running out to this fray, and so she came charging out. She knew I was going to get killed. Everybody there had a problem. Everybody there knew the solution to the problem. Patches, turn loose the damned hog. Turn loose the hog. Well, he didn't turn him loose, but he came off after a while. And as he came off, that old hog whipped around and cut his throat with one of those tusks. And we caught him. And we drug him off the hog, and we petted him, and we patched him up, and we cooled him off, and we loved him. And after a little bit, we turned him loose. And he went right back and got hold of the hog again. Same deal. Dog barking, pig squealing, dad kicking and cussing, me crying, worried about my dog, my mother's out there worried about her kid. Just chaos in the barnyard. Everybody again knew the solution to the problem. Hog knew it, we knew it, everybody knew it. Patches turned loose of that hog. One more time, he came off. Now this time we recognized that something was wrong here. In the words of the psychologist or the psychiatrist, Patch's emotional nature was overriding his intellect. And we knew that Patch's, well, what he really needed was commitment. We needed to commit him. So this time we took him and we tied him under the water fountain. And we let him think about his life. Think back. When was the last time you had any fun getting hold of hogs? Do your friends enjoy you when you get hold of hogs? Does it create problems in your life? How do they taste, Patches? Aren't they nasty? And we left him there, let him cool off, and I stayed with him and petted him and cared for him, and we ran the hog off, and it got quiet in the barnyard, and Patches beginning to get that grin that dogs get on their face, and his tail was wagging a little bit, what there was of it, just about an inch. And after a little while, I went and told the folks, it looks to me like a couple hours is enough for Patches. He's obviously recovered. He's happy. He hasn't got any problems. And we turned him loose, and he had to go 2 miles to find the hog this time, but he got him one more time, you see. And that's alcoholism, isn't it? I was in the first chapter of Hogganon in West Texas. We all were affected by the problem. And everybody seemed to think if we just quit drinking, if we just quit getting hold of a hog, everything would be okay. That's what everyone told me. Jerry, you would be a better lawyer. You'd be a better father, a better husband, a better man, just damn near anything if you just didn't drink the way you drank, if you just wouldn't drink. And I knew that wasn't the answer. And it isn't the answer. Because if drinking was the problem, we'd just stop drinking after a while. But it's the other thing. It's the other problem that old dog had and that I had. What sent me out there the first time? What got me hold of that hog, and why did I go back again and again? And it had to do with the way I thought and the way I reacted to life. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to rethink and rework the ideas of our life. They're called old ideas. And it says we have to give them up. We have to find out what they are, and we have to give them up. And when we do that, and if we follow the process that's outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to do that, our lives are changed so that we live happily and comfortably without the need of alcohol. And in fact, if we don't find a way to live happily and comfortably, and I don't mean giddy and hee-hee and ha-ha all the time, but on the main, to get comfortable with life, we'll drink again. After I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to look back at my life, and I found that I had some ideas that were just kind of goofy, I guess. They didn't seem bad one at a time, but when you put them all together as a way to live, they were really pretty bizarre. I needed to be a man. Now, I'm talking about John Wayne and Robert Redford and all the toughies you ever heard of rolled into one. That's what I needed to be. I needed to be a winner. I wanted your attention. I wanted you to notice when I walked in and say, that guy's a winner. I wanted to be a success in life. I wanted to be important to you. I wanted to be acceptable to you. And I had an outsized idea of how that had to be done. And it wasn't that I wasn't given acceptance. I was raised in this little old West Texas town where they're talking about the baseball game tonight. the little town, if you struck out in the bottom of the ninth with somebody on base and the team lost the ball game, and you were really embarrassed and really felt bad all week long, everybody in that town would buy you malted milks and pat you on the back. If you knocked a home run, they'd pat you on the back and buy you malts for that too. So it was a no-lose deal. But I couldn't see that. I needed to be the winner. I needed to get that hit. I needed to be successful. The problem was that I didn't feel like it was working. I could do the things that a man did, but I didn't feel like I did them right. I remember my dad. He was my role model, and he was a big, rugged guy, farmer, rancher, tough as a boot. And I remember him working on a plow one day, and he hit his hand with a hammer, and blood went everywhere. And he stood up and gave it a good cussing and started to go back to work. And I said, "Dad, did that hurt?" He looked at me with those steely eyes of his and said, "Hell no." And went right back to work. A little while later, I'm out playing like I'm a man. I got me a hammer and I'm beating on the plow. Hit my hand. Didn't hit it very bad, but guess what? Hurt like hell. Hurt like hell, and I cried. I cried, and I was afraid to hammer anymore. So I flunked being a man on three counts in just one instance. And I would have let fear dominated and dictated my life, but I could never concede it. I went out for football when I was in. The coach came through the school one day when I was just about to get into high school, and he picked out some of the kids that he thought might grow into some size. And he said, "You guys can go out for spring football with the high school." Big stuff. I didn't know anything about playing football, but it would sound like a hell of a deal to me. Girls seemed to like it. So I went out, and they showed me how to put on all that damn contraption, you know, and I got it all on, and we went out that afternoon. You put on that uniform, you know, and all them pads and everything, so you won't get hurt, right? Well, I got out there that afternoon, and it's cumbersome to run around in that stuff. And besides that, they started running into me a lot. And they invited me to run into them some. And I want to tell you, that equipment doesn't work very well. It doesn't seem like it. It hurts like hell sometimes. It knocks the wind out of you. And by the time I'd spent a couple hours out there, I had played all the football I ever wanted to play in my entire life. We came in, and on the way in, a couple of my buddies and I were talking, and they told me they'd had enough too. It was not nearly as much fun as, you know, you can get caught up on that fun pretty quick. And they went in, and they were able to get their stuff off quicker than I was. And as they walked out, they told the coach they were through playing football. And as they went off, the coach, when the door closed, the coach began to talk to some of the other high school players there, and he said, talking about yellow stripes running down some people's backs, how some guys had it and some didn't. And they looked around, they saw me, and they said, "Jones, how do you like football?" I said, "I've been wanting to play football all my life." And I was trapped. I played football just as long as I could. Broke bones. You know, I always wanted to be one of those guys that runs into the other guy and he didn't get up. Didn't work that way with me. I ran into him all right, but they got up and I just had to be drug off the field. But I played it as long as I could, and I guess I got to where I liked it. They said it was good for my character. But I led a life that was driven by what you thought I ought to be. Created a lot of pressure in me, and you know the story. Somewhere along the way, I found a way to get relief. And it wasn't spelled R-O-L-A-I-D-S for me, no. It was whiskey. God, I didn't like it much. Terrible taste and stuff. But when it got to the bottom and when it worked, it produced a marvelous result in me. It chemically changed the way the world looked to me. And I never picked up on the fact that this was just a chemical change. It just seemed to me like it really changed things. I was acceptable. You know, the story was we tell. You could dance better. You could talk better. Hell, I don't suppose I danced a lick better. And I damn sure didn't. I've seen some photographs of me when I had a load on. I wasn't any better looking, I'll tell you that. But I got into that stuff, and I liked it. And it became a solution for me. And maybe we do react to it differently than other people. But over the next few years, the next many years, it became the solution for me. It was involved in everything I did. I had absolutely no thought of giving it up. It got me in trouble from the very beginning. It got me hauled in to see the dean of the school. It got me in trouble with the cops. It got me in trouble all the way around. But I never one time gave any serious thought that the price I was having to pay for using alcohol was too much. Because it just wasn't. It was just a marvelous thing for me. And I started going through my life. And the longer I used alcohol to solve my problems, the less able I became to really solve my problems. The less I really appreciated them. I solved problems all around the periphery. I solved little problems and left the big ones alone. I went to the Navy. I wound up in Long Beach. I got married here. My son, a little later, was born down in San Diego. We went back to Texas. I went to law school. All through this period of time, I drank to help me handle life. And as time went along, I drank more and more. I got through law school. I got in the most competitive end of the trial business, of the lawyer business. I'm a trial lawyer. I needed to know whether I was winning or losing. And I was in the middle of winning and losing, and I was fighting. I was mad. I was angry. I became affectionately known in my law firm as the Alligator Gar. And I was proud of that. If you've never seen an Alligator Gar, you may not appreciate that, but that's not anything. You don't see any team mascots called the Gars. It's not a pretty animal. But I was proud of being called that. And I drank whiskey, and I tried lawsuits, and I coped with life as best I could. I had varying degrees of success. The first person to give me any real trouble about my life was the lady sitting down here. She has a kind of strange reaction to the way I drink. God, she overreacts terribly when I have something to drink. And she began to overreact, and it got so bad we finally sent her to a psychiatrist. And he confirmed the fact she was overreacting to the way I drank. And then he wanted to talk to me. And of course, we talked about football and the fact that I had a couple of beers because I was in a high-pressure business and the pace was fast and it was a dog-eat-dog world out there and only the strong survive, and he never got close. He never got close to knowing anything about me. And a little bit later, we had other problems. I remember one time I was a heavy smoker. I smoked a lot and I drank a lot. And I smoked and drank a lot. And then I would go to bed, or she would put me in bed, and I would sleep, and sometime during the night I would come to, and oftentimes she'd put me to bed without taking me to the bathroom, and I'd have to get up and take care of that problem. And I'm one of those automatic smokers. When I turned around and reached over, my hand found the cigarettes and the lighter. No matter how drunk I was, they were there. And I'd light a cigarette, and I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd come back and sit on the side of the bed, and I was very tired. Was very tired many times, and oftentimes I would have to just kind of lay back and relax a little. And yeah, there were a couple times we found little bitty holes burned in the blanket. Nothing to get excited about. Nothing. She was overreacting again. And hell, why do you have a bed cover if you don't cover up things like that for? That's what it's for, isn't it? And I explained all this to her. And then one night I woke up and my side of the bed was blazing pretty good. I got right out of there. We got some water and got it put out, and I don't really remember where I slept the rest of the night. That's real hard to explain how that happens. The best explanation I've ever heard, if it ever happens to you, you could try this, is it must have been on fire when I got in. The next morning, I didn't need to talk to my wife at all. I needed to get the hell out of there. And so, in a very generous mood, I walked out the door and told her, buy any kind of bed you want, and I left. I got back home that night, and she had written me a letter. I don't know why she wrote me a letter. She was still around there someplace. But she wrote it down in a little envelope, and I opened the little envelope and read it, and it said, Dear Jerry, I've been talking to you about your drinking and smoking. It's now reached the point where I can't go to sleep or allow my children to go to sleep in my own home without fear of my life and the lives of our children. You simply have got to do something about your drinking and smoking. And I gave that a good think. And being a responsible man, about a week later, I quit smoking. Never one time did it cross my mind that I could quit drinking. Never thought about it. Kept right on drinking. Kept right on pushing it. Wound up spending most of my time at home. Didn't want to be caught out drunk. Didn't want to be seen drunk. It was threatening to my career. I was a senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas at that time, and I did not want to be thought of or known as an alcoholic lawyer. We had a couple of alcoholic lawyers at my firm. I heard what they said about them, and the message was clear. We're going to get rid of them just as quick as we find a way. So I didn't want to be an alcoholic lawyer. One night, I began to notice some changes in my wife. She was getting happier for some damn reason. She was gone sometimes. One night I asked my daughter where she was, and she said, Daddy, she's gone to a meeting. And I said, what kind of meeting? And she said, oh, I don't know, Daddy, it's a family meeting. Well, we had been talking about discontinuing our family at that time, and it seemed very inappropriate to me that she would go to a meeting to discuss the family without me being present. So when she came in, I engaged in one of my favorite sports. It's called cross-examination of your wife. Billy is really a good witness. She will hide the truth from you and resist telling you the truth when she wants to, as long as any person I've ever encountered. And she was a real bear this day. We started out with questions like, where have you been? Out. What have you been doing? Visiting with friends. Who are they? You wouldn't know them. What did you talk about? We shared our experience, strength, and hope. And we went on and on and on, and I kept narrowing the field, and finally I got it down to a word. She had been to Al-Anon. Al-Anon. I thought that might be some kind of an aluminum kitchen utensil. I wasn't sure. And she was only too happy to tell me what that was. She explained to me that this was an organization that anybody could go to. Anybody who had a friend or a family member who was an alcoholic. And I said, you've been going to public meetings to discuss friends or family members who have alcoholic problems. And my mind was rolling over about 300 miles an hour thinking, who the hell could be the friend or the family member except me? There wasn't a soul within about 3,000 miles that even remotely qualified. Here I was being tried and convicted for something terrible, and I wasn't even getting to tell my side of the damn story. They didn't even know why I drank. They didn't understand what kind of woman I lived with. They didn't understand pressure. And I found out that that was what she had been doing. And I said, you must not go to that meeting anymore. And she said, I need to go. And I said, why? And she said, I have a problem. I said, what is your problem? And she said, my problem is the way you drink. And I said, that sounds like my problem to me. And I want to deal with my problem. And besides, Billy, think what you are doing. Look in the yellow pages. Look under attorneys. Do you see a listing for alcoholic attorneys? No one wants one. That's why you don't see one. Not even alcoholics want an alcoholic attorney. If your clients know that you are alcoholic, they don't let you work for them anymore. If your partners find out you are alcoholic, they ask you to leave. And I told her about those guys down there that they were trying to get rid of, who were in a lot more important positions than I was. I was just sure we had no openings for alcoholic lawyers in my firm. And I explained to her that someone was going to see her at one of those public meetings, and the word was going to filter back that I was an alcoholic. And when that happened, the money would stop. The money would stop. The house, we had a mortgage on the house. If you don't have money, they foreclose on mortgages. They take your house away from you. We had a mortgage on the car. They take your car. I painted her a clear, explicit picture of economic ruin. Professional dishonor. I was through if she didn't quit going to those public meetings. I made that as clear as I have ever made anything in my life. And she said, I need to go. And then I told her, I will kill you if you go. And she said, I'm going. And by God, she did. She kept going. Now, after that point, our life really got bizarre. She had a sponsor. Her sponsor had some of the goofiest ideas I have ever heard in my life. She was always doing new things that didn't make any sense. One of the things her sponsor told her was that she should start each day off with the statement, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." She said she should do that the moment she opened her eyes in the morning. Now, the alarm goes off, and you're laying there in bed, and you've had a quart of whiskey the night before. Your head is going, boom, boom. Your eyes are stuck shut. Your mouth is terribly dry. You're not sure your heart's going to keep beating at all. You're sick at your stomach, and your wife is laying beside you in bed saying, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Well, I damn sure wasn't going to rejoice much that day. I knew that. And she did these crazy things, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. I stayed after her constantly about Al-Anon. If there had been a button I could have pushed and destroyed all the Al-Anons in the world, there'd be a bunch of empty chairs in this room tonight, I'll tell you that. Finally, one night, I was picking a fight with her. And the way I pick fights is I kind of sneak up on them. I decide beforehand I'm going to have a fight, and I need certain facts to win this fight. And I sneak up, and I start getting her to admit those facts before she knows we're in a fight. I started out real easy this particular night. I said, "You know, I've been thinking, you believe that I'm an alcoholic." Easy, huh? She said, "I don't know whether you are or not." I said, what do you mean? You've called me an alcoholic thousands of times." And she said, "Yes, but I was wrong." It's pretty hard to start a fight when they're acting like that, I'll tell you for damn sure. She said, "It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks. It matters only what you think. You're the only person in the knowledge in the world that makes any difference." And then I did something that no self-respecting trial lawyer ever does. I asked a question when I didn't have a goose's idea what the answer was. I said, "Well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it?" Oh, my friends. She pulled the string on me there, I'll tell you that. I set myself up, I asked the question, And I had to listen to the answer. And the answer was, you should try some controlled drinking. You should drink 2 drinks a day, every day for 6 months. Every day, no more, no less. If you can do that for 6 months, you're not an alcoholic. I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. You see, I knew I was drinking a lot, but I was drinking what I wanted to drink. This didn't make any sense to me. I just broke off the damn conversation and got the hell out of there because I was dealing with something I didn't understand. And I went and sat down in my green chair and I began to have a drink and think about this thing. And I had been meaning to cut back. My days at that point in my life consisted of, I got up and I went to work in the morning and had a couple of drinks if I could sneak them in the day at lunch. If I had any appointments or anything, I couldn't drink because I didn't want anybody to think I had any problem with alcohol. And then I stayed at work as long as I could or until I got through and I went home and then I got the bottle down and it was martini time. And I drank a half a quart of Beef Eater's gin. And then I had dinner. A couple of bites of mashed potatoes or something really, really good like that. And then after I had a little bit of supper, I, as most gentlemen do, I switched to brandy. And I drank a half a fifth of brandy in the evening. And then I got up the next day and I did it again. And I'd been doing that for a long time. And I didn't know anyone else who did that. I didn't know anyone that was drinking the way I was drinking. I wasn't drinking with anyone except myself. I was virtually a recluse. I didn't go out anymore. Not much. I just stayed home and drank a quart a day. And went through the hell and the havoc that goes with that in your family. I decided that somebody was going to have to make a sacrifice for our family. It appeared to me that that damn woman was going to, poor demented soul that she was going to keep going to those public meetings. And I had to get her out of that damn Al-Anon. So I decided I'll take the damn test. I'll just take the damn test. And this was the beginning of my recovery. This was the first time in years that I became responsible for the amount I drank. I decided what I was going to drink. I had to change the rules a little bit about the damn test. 2 drinks didn't do me any good. But 3 drinks. I had a good-sized glass. And what I'd do is I'd have 2 big martinis before dinner. I would eat. And then I'd have a big brandy after dinner. And nobody could fuss at me for drinking like that. And they couldn't have. They wouldn't have. Except, I found the first thing about alcoholism. I found that when I had had 2 drinks, just about to finish them, a thought would come to me. Almost always the same. Well, that's about all the martinis today. And then the next thought. What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports this damn family? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was always the same. Hell no. And I went to the bar and drank the bottle. There was a variation on that. There was a couple, as a matter of fact. One was really interesting. This was a very important thing to me, but I could forget to take the damn test for like 2 weeks in a row. Guess what happened when I forgot to take the test? I drank a quart a day. Or I could go to the bar and remember the test and say to myself, I've had a bad day. I just don't feel like screwing with that damn test today. And guess what happened then? I drank a quart. Now, I gave that test a fair chance. I ran it for 1.5 years. I didn't pass the damn test 1 time. Not once. Don't mean I got knee-walking drunk every night, but I got drunk a lot of nights, and I always drank more than I had decided I would drink. And I cannot tell you the number of mornings that I woke up, and when she was rejoicing and praising the Lord, I was thinking to myself, you blew it again. What the hell's wrong with you? What's wrong with you that you can't decide what you want to drink and drink it? And I had no answers for that. I thought I'd lost willpower. I thought I was some kind of a moral leper. I did not know what was wrong with me. But I'm telling you, over that year or year and a half that I did that, that test whipped me like I have never been whipped before. When I got through taking that test, I knew for sure something had me. I didn't have it. The last day I drank was December the 31st, 1972. That day I needed pretty bad to last until midnight to bring in the new year. I'd had a bad December. I'd been inappropriately drunk a number of times. I'd been drunk at a Sunday school party. That's really a bad saying, I tell you. Was the only one drinking there. Sang some really unusual Christmas carols that I'd learned in the Navy. It's hard to explain that to your wife. But she wasn't giving me much trouble. The morning after I sang those carols, I walked in, didn't remember much about what happened the night before, and said, "Well, how'd it go?" And she looked at me with those steely eyes and said, "You were pretty drunk." Pretty drunk. And in a little bit, I remembered what I'd done. But on December the 31st, it's going to last till midnight. I remember waking up and looking out the window, and it was dark outside. And I looked across the room, and Billy was sitting there in a robe, reading one of them damn books. And she said, I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go out to dinner?" She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at my watch, and it was 10 o'clock at night. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sick of me. I was sick of what I was and what I was not. And I had another drink and I went to bed. And I didn't really know that that was the last drink I've had from that day until this. I got up the next morning to the sorriest day I've ever seen. You see, when you have old ideas like I had, when you've developed an event system that keeps you from seeing your alcoholic behavior, and you rationalize and you justify and you suppress and you do everything you can to keep your failure off your mind, you don't learn any lessons. And you need a failure. You need to hit what we call the bottom. And my bottom was simply to recognize that it is not working for me. Nothing in my life is working. I had followed my old ideas, and I was more successful in a material sense than I had ever dreamed I would be. Oh, I was in trouble in my profession, but it hadn't really surfaced yet. I had a house. I had cars. I had things. I had a wife. I had kids. I had everything that's supposed to make you happy. And I was sick. Sick of me. This was the sorriest looking day I had ever seen. And I only knew of one thing after that year and a half of trying to pass that test that I had not tried, and that was to quit drinking altogether. And I had promised myself faithfully back at the time I quit smoking that I would never have to give up another one of my comforts. But that morning I went in and I told Billy, "I'm going to try to quit drinking if I can." And she said, "Would you like for me to call someone from Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Hell no." Hell no. I got myself in this mess, and if anybody gets me out, it'll be me. And she went over to the bookcase and pulled out a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had a little book that was a daily devotional called One Day at a Time. She said, "You may find these helpful." And I threw them against the wall. I said, "You keep this damned AA literature, the AAs, the dogs, the kids, yourself, the hell out of the way. Because I don't know whether I can do this or not." And she said, "You got it." And I didn't do very well with it. You know, you think if you're doing something that's real bad for you and you quit doing it, things ought to get better, shouldn't they? It didn't work that way with me. Strange things began to happen to me in my body. My body was doing things that I wasn't telling it to do. I was shaking on the inside and on the outside. I was walking a lot. I was not in the right place. No matter what I was doing, it was the wrong thing to be doing. If I was inside, I ought to be outside. If I was walking, I ought to be sitting down. If I was sitting down, I ought to lay down for a little bit. I just had the heebie-jeebies. I was real quick, as they say. I had the yippies. You know, you just all at once, your head go yippy, you know, and I had those road maps on my nose. I couldn't sleep. Can you believe that? I couldn't sleep. And I walked the streets of Dallas, and I looked at people, and they were going about their lives. Functioning, happy people. And I couldn't think about anything but drinking. And I got lucky. I decided that I would sneak in and read one of those books about the second day. Didn't have time to read the big one, because she might come in and I didn't want to be caught reading that crap. But I got the little one and opened it up to see what the hell it was, and it's got a date in the upper corner of each page. And with my keen alcoholic mind, I thought, there's one for today, and I looked on January the 2nd. And it gave me the solution. This year you're going to give your drinking problem to God. I cannot tell you how disappointed I was in that system. How are you going to give something to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for God all my life. I've been in every kind of church you can think of. I've been to all kinds of preachers. I've read books. I've done everything. I went down to the front and got dedicated. I've been rededicated. I've been dunked. I've been sprinkled. That whole bit came my way. And I kept thinking, if I keep doing these things, something's going to work. Remember when I went down to the front? I waited for it to happen in the back of the church. I wanted something spectacular to happen to me. I wanted that bush to talk to me, or to see some fire, or to hear the music of the spheres, or something bizarre, so I'd know for sure that I wasn't being conned. I had a rather skeptical view of this religious business. And I went down to the front that night, and everybody hugged me and made over me and said, oh, this is wonderful, and said, Jerry, don't you feel different? And you know what I told them. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel a lot different. I did. I was more disappointed than I'd ever been, because not a damn thing had happened. And I'd just about given up on this God thing. And I'd faked it. I'd been a hypocrite, which is what I accused everybody else of being. And this day, I tossed that little book out in the center of the table and I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. Best prayer I guess I ever said, because the next day I knew I wasn't going to make it by myself. I was going to have some help. I wanted some help that had skin on it, though. I had to find some people, and I called the only place I knew to call, which was Alcoholics Anonymous, and begin to argue with you about what I should do about my recovery. As you told me I needed to go to meetings every night, I said, oh no, I can't do that. I'm willing to get help, but I can't do that. Why? Well, I'm very busy. I'm a very busy man. What do you do every night? Well, I drink, get home. Well, we're going to stop that so you'll have time to drink, you know, come to meetings now, won't you? I didn't want to go to those public meetings and be seen, scared to death of my anonymity. Finally, I got into a little old group called the Town and Country Group. I thought it would be close to a country club or something like that, and would have nothing but college graduates or something. Didn't turn out that way. And it was a bunch of old-timers that met, sort of a little maintenance group, I guess you'd call it. And into that group one night, just by luck, came David. David came in, and David had 6 glorious months of sobriety. Everybody else in that group had years of sobriety. I didn't think they were really alcoholics. Hell, you can't stay sober as long as they'd been sober if you got my kind of problem. I was not convinced at all. But David still had the yippies. You know, he was still quick. He had literature sticking out of every pocket. He had the road maps on his nose. And after the meeting, I got out of there and I said, what do you think about this Alcoholics Anonymous thing? And David said, you talking about this little meeting? He said, oh, this is not for us. That sounded good to me. He said, we need to go to a lot of meetings. We need to go every night. We need to be involved in AA. We got to learn to do the steps. We got to listen to speakers. We got to work with new drunks. We got to get in the middle of this thing or we're going to die drunk. And he hooked me because I said, where are we going to go? And I followed him into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous. I gave it good effort. I didn't like you. I didn't like what you did. I thought you were corny as hell. People stand, grown men stand up at the podium and say, my name's whatever, and everybody says, hi, George. God. Next thing I know, you're going to be teaching me the secret grip or some damn thing like that. The Royal Order of the Moose, or I don't know what it's called. But I stayed. And I began to see some people who experienced life the way you began to watch them. They didn't talk about their swimming pools or their cars or anything. They began to talk about their lives. And they shared their lives with me. And I identified with them. And I asked them what they had done. And they told me what they had done. And I began to do what they asked me to do. I found a thing called self-centeredness. They told me that I needed a power greater than myself. They said that self-centeredness separated me from that power. That I had to be involved in my recovery. Nobody was going to fix me. That I needed to find self-centeredness, and when I found it, told somebody about it, recognized what it was doing in my life, that I would begin to experience the power. Said, you don't have to believe it. We don't care whether you believe it or not. You don't have to have any faith. Just take the action. And I began to do that. And as I listened to these people, I learned some things. I remember one night I was listening, and I didn't think my life was very unmanageable, and I certainly didn't think I was self-centered. Certainly not selfish. I was generous with my wife and my children. Remember how I bought that bed? God, I just would do anything for them. And I was sitting there this night, and I remembered what I used to do when I was taking the test and flunking it. I grew tired of watching television. And I bought me a fishbowl. It was my fishbowl. I put it on between my chair and the wall. I put the kind of gravel in it that I liked. I put the kind of flora and fauna in there that I liked. And I put the kind of fish in there that I liked. I like pretty, slow-swimming fish. I put a light on it. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. I fed my fish if they were to be fed. Sometimes it was the land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. And as I was sitting in this meeting, listening to conversation about selfishness and self-centeredness and unmanageability and all those wonderful subjects, I began to think about that damn fishbowl. And I remembered that there was always, always one damn fish. I could watch those fish by the hour. They'd go up and get a little tidbit of food and sail back down to the body. It was just wonderful to watch them. I'd dream wild dreams and watch those damn fish. But this one bad fish would begin to get after the others. And he'd reach up and he'd generally pick the prettiest fish and begin to nip him on the tail. And the pretty fish would begin to swim faster. And as he swam faster, he passed other fish. And they began to swim faster too. And the first thing you know, the whole damn bowl was just going back and forth like that. And it would infuriate me, and I'd reach over and I'd bang the side of that thing. Boom! Let them know there's a power greater than they are out there somewhere that's displeased. And they'd stop for a minute. And I was fair. I was fair. You'd think they'd stop and learn a lesson after that, but sometimes they did it again. And I'd bang the bowl. I gave the rule of threes. I gave them three claps of thunder. Some fish continued to misbehave even after three claps of thunder. Then I bought me a little dip net. And I would reach in there and I would catch the offending fish. And I would haul him out and put him on my lap. And I would have a drink and I'd think about all those people out there in the world I wish I could get my dip net on, you know. Then I would put them back in. Timing is very important here. You know you've kept them out too long if they float. But I generally got pretty good at that. I got them back in the tank, and you'd know with three claps of thunder, three hands-on experience with the power, they would learn. There are such unfortunates. They seem to be born with them.
Those I simply hauled out of there, looked neither left or right, took them to the toilet and flushed them. Not a soul in the world knew I was playing that game. But I got to thinking that night, you know, I've been sitting here feeling like my life's unmanageable, is manageable. I've done pretty well, thank you. Like I wasn't self-centered. And it occurred to me that there are a lot of adult American men who are 41 years old who don't spend their time trying to discipline fish. Who don't take misbehaving fish seriously enough to go to all the trouble to try to punish them. Manage life, hell, I couldn't run a fishbowl. And a little at a time, you got me. And then one time, the greatest thing I guess happened to me, that's one of the greatest days of my life in the program. One day I went to a meeting, not because I needed a meeting, but because I wanted to be a part of an AA meeting. I liked what was going on there. I was interested in what old Bill did. Did he get his job back? Did Sam stay sober? Did Mary get her kids? I became a part of a solution. I had a purpose in life. I had a place to be. I had special skills that no one else had except another alcoholic. I could reach people. I got to go on 12-step calls. Driving home one night from one of those meetings, I started singing a song. I looked around real quick to see that nobody was watching me because I hadn't sung a song in a long time. Something was happening to me. The anger was going away. We hadn't worked on my anger. We hadn't worked on my fear. Sure, they told me to ventilate it, talk about it, but we don't fix those things in AA. We don't deal with anger well. We tried to deal with it and wallow around with it and practice all this Freudian stuff for years and stayed dead drunk. What happens to us in Alcoholics Anonymous is we get caught up in the solution. And the solution is working with other people. Trying to be of maximum service to God and your fellow man. Carry the message to other alcoholics. What's the message? The message and the promise are the same. The power does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. You look around one day and you're not angry anymore. You look around one day and you're functioning in life without fear. You found a purpose in life. And that came to me. That came to me in my life just really took off. The first 5 years I spent in Alcoholics Anonymous were the most exciting 5 years of my life. I went to meetings every day. I still go to a lot of meetings. I'm still involved with the process. I just love it. It's the most exciting thing I do now. I've got me a newcomers group that I'm involved with now. And I mean, I got about 35 people with less than a year that I'm having just a lot of fun helping them through that first year of sobriety. Got some other people help me. It's not just me. It's the program working again. But I'm getting to be involved. And I really, really enjoy that. It's the most rewarding thing in my life. All the terrible things that I did, all the bad feelings I had about myself are one day just gone. All those old events have become assets. All those old feelings have become assets. I can talk to somebody about them. I can tell them about them. I didn't fix them. I don't know how they got fixed. Just one day, I didn't have them anymore. And you know, I was able to see in my life that there was a power at work. You don't see this power. It's like gravity. You don't see gravity, do you? Step off the building and see if it works. Works every time. This power works the same way. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to bring us in contact with that power, to allow us to have a spiritual awakening, to find out what's going on in the world. And we get fixed. We get to see hands-on experience of people's lives who are absolutely turned around through this power. People that you and I couldn't touch. People that doctors and psychiatrists and therapists and counselors give up on get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, any one of these other things, all the treatment programs, all the other things will work if the person practices the principle of Alcoholics Anonymous. But take that away. Water that down. and you'll lose it. The miracles will cease to happen. I believe that with every fiber of my being. You and I did not deserve this program. We just didn't. You and I didn't deserve to put our families back together, or to live without our families, or to get back on the road to decent jobs and support ourselves and begin to feel good about ourselves again. We didn't. We didn't do a damn thing to deserve that. Matter of fact, it went the other way. But the fact is, it came to us. And as our book says, to those whom much is given, much is expected. We have an obligation. There are lots of 12-step programs today. There are a lot of people who are looking at this program and that program and are moving around a lot. That's their right. I have nothing to say about those other programs. That's their business. I wish them well. But if you're an alcoholic, don't try to practice the 12 steps by doing 3 of each of 4 programs. What we have is enough. It deals with every problem. It deals with all the blame you may have against somebody else. There's one line in the book that talks about the blame we have. It says that's about as far as we ever got, was to blame other people for our problem. The rest of the time it's focused on us. The rest of the time it's letting us be aware of what's going on in our lives. And the miracle is working. The miracle is working. Do you realize what a miracle it is to be in this room tonight? If we sat down and made a list of all the crimes that had been committed by people in this room tonight, would it be a fairly substantial list? Have any of you ever stiffed somebody on a debt that you owed them? Paid your child support or didn't pay your child support? Walked off from all kinds of difficult problems in your life? We have done every damn thing there is to do. Now, what would it be if you went to the mayor of Long Beach and said, look, I've got a bunch of people, several thousand, who've really got a tacky track record. But we'd like to get together in your city and have a little conference. Do you see that's what's happening here? We are those people. We had that experience. And through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're welcomed here. They seek our conferences. It's happening all across the United States. The only risk it runs is that we quit practicing it. That we, as Dr. Bob warned us, got tangled up with a bunch of Freudian concepts and forgot the basic principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, the real secret is service. The real secret is to give of yourself to another person. And that's why we're always focused on the newcomer. That's why he or she is the most important person in the room to me. It's just marvelous to be a part of a person's life that's getting better and getting well. It came to us. It came to us. We didn't deserve it. We're just the recipients of it. But we have the obligation to keep it alive because there's an epidemic out there. There's an epidemic of alcoholism going on tonight. And those guys on the streets tonight, the only chance they got is for you and I to be there for them, just like the old timer was there for us. And you never graduate. You never get over it. It's always there, and it's always good, and it's always... You never feel bad when you do it. You never have to worry about your self-esteem when you're helping another human being. You just feel good about yourself. You know you're doing the right thing at the right time. God has done for us what we could not do for ourselves. Thank you again for having us. It's been a great honor.